The Tom Woods Show, episode 1142.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, my Away carry-on helps make my travel a pleasure. It's super strong yet lightweight, and it's even got its own USB charger built in. I'm like the king of the airport with this thing. Take $20 off your suitcase order when you head to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS at checkout.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Bob Murphy is back with us today. Bob, of course, is my co-host over on the Contra Krugman podcast at ContraKrugman.com. He holds a PhD in economics from New York University, author of numerous books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and many others. His most recent title is The Case for IBC, the Infinite Banking Concept. We'll have him on to talk about that at some point. Then before that, it was The Primal Prescription, which was a book on health and medical care and the free market. And then before that, his book Choice, subtitled Cooperation, Enterprise, and Human Action, which is a great distillation of Ludwig von Mises. So great stuff. You should check him out at consultingbyrpm.com. And of course, the two of us together host the Contra Cruise over at ContraCruise.com. All right, that's about enough websites to be sending you to. Let's talk to Bob. Now we're going to talk about public choice economics today. We intended to get to that in a previous episode, and we got talking about another topic. So we're going to focus today on public choice economics because it helps you better understand why the outcomes of politics are as perverse as they are. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Always a pleasure.
So we're talking public choice today. I've done this before, but I think it was something like 783 episodes ago. And I know there are fearless Tom Woods Show listeners who just, they would crawl over broken glass before they would miss an episode. But they may not remember all the details of that one. And plus, this is a Murphy episode, right? That trumps all episodes on a topic that come before. So explain what public choice means. I know that a lot of folks listening have heard it before, but I bet this is the kind of term that gets thrown around. Oh, yeah, you know, there's a good public choice explanation for that. And people sit in the room thinking, yeah, I'm sure there is. If I had any idea what public choice was, maybe I'd know what that is. We are the revealers of all the inner secrets of the mystical language of the libertarian movement. So, Bob, that is your job today. Start off by telling us what public choice is all about.
Yeah, it's true. The other economists get mad at me for revealing these trade secrets, but I don't care.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And maybe we should be disguising your voice and your identity, but we're just going to cross our fingers.
Oh, I'm someone from Texas.
Yeah, that's right. Now I think we'll just go with your regular voice.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So yeah, the term public choice, let's just stop for a second and, you know, where'd that come from? So the idea is it's talking about things, you know, decisions that humans need to make, but in the context, not as a private choice, right? When you go to the grocery store and you decide how many gallons of milk you want to buy, that's a private choice. And that's why normal economic theory is applied to that situation. That's how historically it was developed. And economists have no problem explaining private choices with the tools of economics. So what public choice is, it's saying, let's take our standard economic toolkit and then apply that to choices that the public makes. And typically, of course, that's meaning in the context of government policies, government decisions, the whole mechanism of the political process. That's how the public makes choices. And so we're going to deploy our traditional economic tools into that arena. So that's kind of what it is.
Can you believe I've known about this for years and years, and I never put two and two together to figure out the meaning behind the term until just this moment. So very good work.
And if I may pat myself on the back, I don't know that anyone ever said that to me. So for all I know, I'm just making that up, and maybe, you know, Gordon Tullock just rolled some dice and that was the term that popped out. But I believe that's what I said is very plausible, and I'm sure that's what it means.
Yeah, but I feel like he would, after the fact, want to say, yeah, that's what I had in mind, even if he didn't, because that was such an elegant explanation.
It's kind of like, I think I was about 20 years old before I realized that Thanksgiving was a giving of thanks. Up till then, it had just been Thanksgiving. I hadn't really thought about what the word meant. So there you go.
So, okay, so you have trouble with the simplest word there is, but I had trouble. All right, anyway, let's get back to public choice.
It's because of the historical oppression. I just blotted it out.
Yeah, well, fair enough. You're a very sensitive person. So let's talk about what the implications of this are. All right, so we do study private choices, but the sorts of choices we make when it comes to the so-called public sector or public life can be analyzed to some degree with the same kind of analytical tools. But what sorts of things do we discover that is of any value or that we wouldn't have known just thinking about it casually rather than systematically?
So traditionally, when people talk about public choice, they have in mind economists who tend to be very skeptical of government policies and that they... So one easy way to sort of motivate this discussion is to say, up until the public choice school came on the scene, economists were really big about diagnosing market failure, right? They could come up with all sorts of theoretical models and show under certain conditions how the invisible hand breaks down in this, you know, if there's negative externalities, if there's public goods, all these ways in which the standard profit and loss mechanism in the private choice setting would lead to a suboptimal outcome. And then they would just matter of factly say, and so that's why government intervention is justified here to fix this market failure. So one way to sort of motivate the findings of the public choice school is to say they focused on government failure. So it's more of a comparative systems or comparative institutional framework analysis where they would say, for example, it seems a bit inconsistent to say, all the people in the private sector, all they want to do is maximize profit. And so, airline executives, if it's cheaper to cut down on safety inspections, even if that means there's a higher chance of a plane crashing and they don't care if their customers die, they just run the numbers and see, well, we might have lawsuits and but we save money by having fewer inspections. So we'll go ahead and do the cheap thing to cut corners, even though more people die. That's fine if you want to use that analysis and assume that all businessmen care about is maximizing shareholder value, but then don't assume that the bureaucrats in charge of the FAA are motivated purely by altruism. You have to be consistent and say, let's look at their incentives and let's assume the people in the FAA, all they care about is maximizing their budget. And you realize perverse things like, okay, suppose there is a plane crash and suppose the newspaper reporters get in there and they realize the FAA was behind on the inspections that they themselves promulgated as necessary. What's going to happen? Is the FAA's budget going to get cut? On the contrary, people in Congress are going to be pounding the table saying, with this woefully underfunded, government service agency, that's why people are dying and falling out of the skies. We need more funding. And so things like that where you say, okay, let's just be consistent. And if we're going to assume people in the private sector are selfish profit maximizers, not that they're malicious, misanthropes, but just to say, let's not just assume they always do stuff out of the goodness of their heart. It's got to reward them personally. Likewise, the public choice school looks at government officials and say, let's look at the actual incentives these various decision makers have to make and then or face and then see how things turn out. And it turns out that makes a lot better sense of the world than the model that, for example, just to give something positive, isn't it kind of amazing if economists are right, well, at least before 1990, when the consensus on minimum wage laws, now that's sort of been challenged. But before then, it was true to say economists on the right and the left agreed that minimum wage laws hurt teenage employment. And so it seems weird. Like, so are all the people, all the senators, they don't have a single economist on their staff. They're all just misinformed. And you say, well, no, actually, what makes better sense is that they get contributions from labor unions. And so they're lying. They get up there and say that they're voting for this because they want to help low-skilled people earn a living wage or whatever the rhetoric is. But actually, no, they know full well what they're doing, and they're doing it because they want to maximize their chance at re-election. So it's just a better theory. And again, the point is that it's just being consistent. That, yeah, there's market failure if you want to use those models, but there's also government failure.
Now, it turns out that public choice can also be used to look at the behavior of the voting public. And this is important too, because what we'll hear from defenders of government will be that, sure, there is the possibility that bad people could be elected or there could be corruption or the wrong decisions could be made, but at least we have the voting public to correct that so that in the next election, maybe we'll do better, we'll get more competent people, more civic-minded people. And you can use public choice analysis also to understand a little bit more about voting behavior so as to show that this way of looking at it might likewise be naive.
Yeah, exactly. So let me take a brief digression here just to plug another element of the Liberty Classroom course that I've done for you, Tom. I didn't do it for you, Tom. I did it for the people out there, the teeming masses.
No doubt.
Yes. This was the lecture I did on Arrows, what's called Arrows and Possibility Theorem, named after the Nobel Prize winning economist Kenneth Arrow. And it's related. So what people have heard of this, what that is, it's Arrow did this very systematic, rigorous mathematical analysis of any type of social choice procedure. So it would include, you know, any kind of political decision making. And he had very weak assumptions, very weak conditions, saying we want a procedure that what this thing does is, he just said, it maps from the group of the citizens' individual subjective preferences, you know, their rankings of possible states of the world, if you will, from best to worst. You take that as given from all the citizens. They each have their unique subjective rankings of how things are, how they view different states of the world. And then you want to map from that into a social choice ordering. And Arrow had very weak conditions, things like saying, we don't want there to be one person who always gets his way. So that's like saying non-dictatorship. There's not one person whose preferences just automatically equal society's preferences. Things like that. A weak principle where if every single person in society thinks outcome A is better than outcome B, then it better be the case that the social choice function has the same, you know, pattern. Things like that. And then Arrow concluded that the set of such social choice functions is empty, meaning there is no way of designing a procedure, even mathematically, that satisfies all these very plausible, very intuitive conditions. And so the reason I bring that up is, number one, it's kind of cool, and the proof is actually not that hard. So we actually do that in the Liberty Classroom course for those who are purists, just to show this is what, you know, a real rigorous proof looks like if you're curious. But beyond that, in any other context, this would have just been a devastating result. Like if someone had done something like this for markets and proved that market allocation in principle could never be efficient, Paul Krugman would be running victory laps at this till the end of time and saying these right-wing ideologues are ignoring basic math. And yet this thing that should have just destroyed any attempts to, you know, hold up democracy as this great ideal, I've even seen it get flipped on its head, Tom, where one time an economist proposed something and I pointed out that there was a flaw in his, you know, the voting procedure where there's conditions under which some absurdity could result. And he answered, so yeah, well, Arrow's impossibility theorem showed that in general, voting is never going to lead to something, you know, efficient. So that's not a criticism of my particular proposal. So some ways. So anyway, there's that element in terms of just in general, the flaws with voting procedures. There's this general result that progressive economists saw that and they were like, wow, that's amazing, Arrow, good job. And then they kind of just moved on and said, well, let's assume, you know, certain conditions in which that doesn't apply. But coming back to the more narrow question of voter behavior per se, you're right that standard public choice models, they will look and say, okay, suppose you as a voter are looking at the voting procedure purely as an instrumental mechanism, and you'll come up with stuff like saying, okay, what? It's not a question of, do I have a preference? Like, yeah, maybe I have a preference between Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump being president, but is it worth it to me to go to the polls and pull the lever? And so if you use standard economic reasoning, you know, you would say something like, okay, well, the chance of my voting or my vote mattering is, first of all, my state has to be decisive in the Electoral College, so I got to figure that out. And then my vote has to be decisive in which way my state goes and determines, you know, how the electoral votes get allocated. And so, you know, under any plausible scenario, the chance of that is astronomically small. You're more likely to get killed in a car accident going to the voting booth than to have your vote actually determine who the next president's going to be. So there's results like that that sort of make it, you know, cast doubt upon traditional explanations of why would people vote. And it explains things, right? So there's what's called rational ignorance. So it sort of makes sense. There's lots of very intelligent people who have no idea who their state representatives are. Or they don't even, you know, some people might not know who their senators are. And at first you might say, oh, those idiots, they don't care about the political, but the, you know, public choice school theory might say, well, no, that makes perfect sense. You should focus on stuff that actually directly affects you. And yeah, you go, you know, you're going to spend a lot of time researching before you buy a new car because you can control that. Whereas you can spend all your time researching the issues and whatever, and your vote is going to matter as much as the guy down the street who just saw some fancy bumper sticker, who saw Bernie Sanders on TV said, I'm going to give you free health care in college. And he went and cast a vote, even though he studied the issues for 8 minutes. And his vote matters just as much as yours does. Whereas that guy can't determine what car you get. You get to determine what car you get. And so that's why you spend a lot more time and effort on your private purchasing decisions.
And then when we think about the allocation of energy toward political lobbying, it's necessarily skewed in favor of people with some kind of selfish agenda. I was going to say self-regarding, but self-regarding is morally neutral. But selfish agenda, because you know, the classic example we can think about, sugar quotas. Well, you know, sugar quotas don't benefit you and me. I mean, yeah, I know you shouldn't eat sugar. Maybe that's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying. If I want to eat sugar and there are sugar quotas, that makes sugar more expensive for me. But it does benefit other people, benefits domestic producers who now can get away with charging higher prices than they did otherwise. And so those people are getting, there are a few of them, and they're getting a concentrated benefit, whereas the rest of us are spread out. And the fact that I pay an extra 5 cents a day for sugar is so minimal to me that it would be inane for me to waste my time organizing politically against it or sending lobbyists against it. So there's a built-in tendency in favor of further and further government expansion because, well, the people who have an interest in that are the ones who are going to also have the financial incentive to actually organize to bring it about. And so you wind up getting this gradual increase in the size of government. Now, here's my question for you. I'm trying to think of how do we fit the collapse of the Soviet Union into public choice? Or would the public choice people say, well, we can't anticipate large ideological changes like that, and the way we're thinking applies just in general mundane circumstances. And sure, a revolutionary fervor can come here and there, and that's going to challenge any theory. But it does seem to challenge the public choice idea that we're kind of stuck because the incentives being the way they are, the state just always wins.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Just to elaborate on your first part there, what's invoked there, the principle would be concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. So the classic ways to explain things like tariffs. Why is it so hard to get free trade? Because as you say, that, with protecting, something that says, oh, limits Japanese imports of cars, that confers a lot of benefits on Detroit auto workers and the shareholders and, the U.S. automakers, and it makes car prices a little bit more expensive for all Americans. So yes, if somebody proposes eliminating that, even though the gains to the winners are bigger than the losses to the losers, and so it's efficient the way certain mainstream economists would use that term, nonetheless, it might not go through for the exact reason you say, that the automakers have all kinds of incentive to spend lots of money lobbying to keep that and to have ad campaigns about protect U.S. workers and all that kind of stuff. So you're right, though, that even though the theory is elegant and it can explain a lot of the status quo, it does have difficulty explaining sudden huge movements. And even in general, just going back to the point we said earlier, there's a sort of paradox involved that the sort of rational choice approach to modeling voting behavior should say that in equilibrium, very few people should vote, right? That in other words, So even though the economists who like this model can think, pat themselves on the back and say, aha, we can show after all that the very intelligent person who studied political economy for 17 years rationally chooses not to vote. But then on the other hand, it doesn't really explain, okay, but then how come millions of people do vote? And if you ask them why, they'll say stuff like, well, because I hate Hillary Clinton or I hate Donald Trump. And you can sit there and say, but that doesn't make sense. And clearly that's not the way they're making decisions. And yet those millions of people, they do obey downward sloping demand curves and such when they go to the grocery store, right? So you can't just say, well, they're completely irrational and economics doesn't apply to them. That no, it does seem to work in the private marketplace, the arena for which these standard tools were developed. And yet it doesn't seem to work very well when it comes to explaining their political behavior. And so it leads you to wonder, is it that the model's wrong or just these people aren't acting right according to the economist's conception? So I think you're right, Tom. I mean, in general, yes, during a dictatorship or even broader, like how do you generals motivate their troops? I mean, individually, it seems kind of crazy. You want me to storm that hill? No way. And yet if we all do it, then some of us will get through. So there are things like that where these types of models can explain some elements of reality, but it does seem like people are motivated for things other than just the narrow pecuniary or, you know, other self-interested behavior would indicate. But, and so, yeah, you know, it's a toss up to say, well, yeah, so the model's not perfect, or to say, you know what, this is the wrong path to go down when it comes to this kind of behavior.
But on the other hand, a public choicer could come back and say, when people do nevertheless go and vote, though, what we can observe, what we can glean from this through a public choice lens is that a lot of times the basis on which they make that voting decision is a basis on which they would never make any other kind of decision. Like, they would not decide which smartphone to get because there was a sign in their neighbor's yard, or because their friend knows the guy's cousin, or, you know, who runs the company. I mean, they would research that because they've got some skin in the game, so to speak, and their purchase decision has immediate consequences for them, whereas their voting decision has no immediate consequence. So whether they do it or they don't isn't going to affect anybody, but whether they do or they don't slam down those dollars for that smartphone does affect them. And they're generally not motivated. When you go to buy a smartphone or a plasma or a flat screen TV, you're not motivated by spite or I'm getting this flat screen TV just to prevent that other flat screen TV from entering my house. Like, we don't act that way in any other aspect of our lives. So that helps to reinforce the fact that clearly there's something screwy about politics in particular.
Oh, sure. So yeah, I'm just trying to lay out both sides. Obviously, I think the public choice school offers a lot of insights, and I'm glad that, you know, the writers in that tradition wrote what they did, because I think it does explain certain things. All I'm pointing out is that in certain applications, they do paint themselves into a corner. Well, you'll see someone using an analysis that explains like how politicians, like for example, there's a standard result called the median voter model. Like, so it's well known, just, you know, observationally, that in the primaries, the Democrat is more liberal and the Republican's more conservative. And then the general election, what do? They move towards the center. So you can explain this very easily in a public choice framework by saying that, you know, the candidates in the primary, what you're trying to do is maximize your vote given what the voting bloc's preferences are. And so if you assume that people vote for the candidate who's most like their own position, then what the optimal thing to do if you're a candidate is to have the views of the median voter, right? So that you know, you wouldn't want to be way to the left of that, because then you would only capture the people on the left wing and you'd miss out the people to the right, and so on. So given that the various candidates all try to move towards the middle to maximize their vote, what you see, you know, that makes perfect sense. But then in that framework, again, it's like that's just taking for granted that the people go to the polls and they vote for the candidate who's closest to their view. And you can put in a thing like, and if the person's too far away, they just stay home. But my point is just that a lot of these models, when you actually build the model, the logic that they're deploying to explain the actions and motivations and incentives of one group of decision makers in the model, if you apply that consistently to everybody else in the model, then it would break down. That to explain why policymakers or candidates move towards the middle, usually in these models, they just assume voting behavior is given and they don't use the same framework to explain, well, why are people voting in the first place? Because in general, again, with millions of people showing up, no individual wants to vote. And so that can't be an equilibrium. So you're right. I'm saying you can piecemeal explain things, but there are these like hidden paradoxes where it's a little bit tricky and you got to resort to some ad hocery to explain to get the thing off the ground.
More to come with Bob Murphy after we thank our sponsor. Hey folks, last week I was in New York City to see Bob Murphy debate George Selgin, and then this weekend I'm heading back there to visit a little bit more, and both times one of my trusty companions either was or will be my away carry-on. It was designed by a couple of friends in New York who found themselves stuck at JFK with dead phones, delayed flights, and frustration. Well, my Away carry-on charges up all my devices that use a USB cord, but it's also super strong and yet lightweight. It glides through the airport like something out of heaven. It's got an amazing compression system for overpackers, and with a lifetime warranty and a 100-day trial, how can you go wrong? Not to mention free shipping on any Away order to the lower 48 states. Plus, Take $20 off a suitcase when you go to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS at checkout. That's awaytravel.com/woods and promo code WOODS. Some people listening might be inclined to think that really public choice then is nothing but fancy dressed up cynicism, you know, with some analytical apparatus or something. But really, that's all it is. But it actually is more than that and yields you more actionable or interesting results than just old-fashioned cynicism. So give me an example of how that's so.
Sure. So let me just sort of talk about my own evolution on this stuff. So when I was much younger, you know, I read Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Oh, wow, and I'm getting into libertarianism. I discovered Austrian economics. And so there was a period, well, actually, I know exactly when it was. It was when I took, up until I took the public choice course from Gary Wolfram at Hillsdale College. That's what shattered my illusions. So up until then, I had naively thought that, oh, you know, the government is just full of these bumbling, incompetent fools who, for some reason, are completely ignorant of the effects of the minimum wage law. And they do all kinds of things. And you know, you'll still see some conservative types mock the government in the following. They'll say things like, oh yeah, the federal, you know, Uncle Sam is so stupid. He doesn't know what the right hand's, you know, the left hand's doing, and the right hand's doing. For example, the same federal government that subsidizes tobacco farmers, they'll also use our tax dollars to fund anti-smoking ads for kids. And come on, or, you know, they'll require warning labels and things. So that's kind of silly. Like, why doesn't the government make up its mind? Does it want to encourage smoking or not? And say, ha ha, that's funny. But if that's really what your understanding of the world is, well, then you're going to be clueless and helpless to stop the advance of big government because you really have no idea what's driving it. So that those programs make perfect sense. That, you know, there are certain interests that obviously, like, farmers benefit from getting subsidies. And so if there's a subsidy for them to plant tobacco, that's in place. And it's going to be hard to dislodge that for the reasons we've already talked about. And there are different constituencies who benefit from, you know, public ads to discourage teen smoking. And there's, you know, groups in favor of that for, you know, altruistic reasons or whatever the reasons may be, busybody types, what have you. And so they, you know, given that there's money in place and programs in place, and there are people whose job it is to administer such programs, they're going to raise a fit if someone tries to eliminate that. So the crucial thing is to not look at the U.S. government as an independent acting agent, right? There's no Uncle Sam is a metaphor. There really isn't somebody. And so if you use methodological individualism to break down the actions of, quote, the federal government into the more specific individualized behavior or actions of the individuals who at any given time compose the personnel making up the U.S. federal government and the related, you know, agencies and the deep state and blah, 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 and all these other things, then that makes much more sense of the world. And so the public choice analysis was really, I think, pioneering in that respect, is to look at officials who happen to be in government positions and just apply normal analysis to them and not just take it for granted that they're going to do what they say they're going to do in their speeches. To say, no, let's look at actually what the incentives are facing these people.
All right, we're just about done with the conversation. What was I supposed to do with any of this to promote the cruise? I don't see. I've thought of every possible transition I could make into promoting the cruise.
Because it's in both of our interests to promote the cruise. So you would think public choice would predict.
Yeah, that we would have done it by now. And yet here we are on the air, no less, speculating on how can we segue into a discussion of the cruise.
I guess you know where the rationally ignorant consumer will do a lot of research and realize that it's the right product choice to make.
When they're looking around for cruises and they choose the Contra Cruise?
Yes, that is a rational decision.
All right.
It maximizes utility.
Given that these days I get a lot of people saying, I'm listening to your show for the first time, I'm just starting to listen. I had a lot of people come on my list with my ebook on guns. There may be people who don't know about the Contra Cruise, and that's sad because it is the greatest vacation in the history of the world, because you're going to spend a week on a luxurious ship with Bob and me and special guests. We got Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute coming. We now have Brett Vinat of the School Sucks podcast joining us for the week, and he is absolutely brilliant and great and wonderful to spend time with. You have amazing good folks you're just going to love, and your fellow cruisers. Fun games, a little bit of learning, plenty of music and...
Tatiana Moreau's recently confirmed. Remember, she's coming.
Tatiana has confirmed. This will be her third year in a row coming with us. But it is the most fun you can possibly imagine. And you're with like-minded people who are just delighted that you're there. So check out the video that we have. It's from our first year. The second year was even better than the first. But we have a video from the first year at ContraCruise.com. Of course, it's named that because our podcast that Bob and I do together, remember, is Contra Krugman. So that thing was just a natural. So you definitely want to join us and not pass this up. It's later this year in 2018, Mexican Riviera, beautiful, wonderful, tremendous time. So ContraCruise.com. Anything else we want to say here? Well, also, you should get Bob's courses because you get every single course we have over at LibertyClassroom.com. That's where you learn the stuff that they kept from you in school. You know, I used to say, you know, and I basically the motto is still is the history and economics they didn't teach you. But a friend of mine recommended the history and economics they kept from you, which is just as good a tagline if you ask me. But either way, LibertyClassroom.com. You get discounts there, by the way. We've got LibertyClassroom.com/coupons. And I know you don't like my pronunciation of coupons. That's why I'm going to say it a couple more times. LibertyClassroom.com/coupons is where you can get a discount on that. Where do you come down on the whole I'm going to prom, I'm going to the prom thing? When we were growing up, even though you're kind of a youngster compared to me, it was I'm going to the prom, right? I'm going to the prom. This weird, emasculating, bizarre dropping of the definite article is insanity.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at that time in my life, what I would have said is, I'm going to watch Star Trek The Next Generation.
I gave you that one. That was so easy.
No, I would have said the prom. I think.
Yeah,
the,
of course.
Yeah, going to
so
prom.
So what happened?
Weird.
What happened
know.
In our society?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Prepositional dysfunction.
It's shocking to me. And then everybody's just going along with it like there's nothing wrong. And I would say, people, I was alive with you 30 years ago when we all said, I'm going to the prom. You know, what in the world is wrong with you? You say, I'm going to the dance. The prom is a dance. I'm going to the prom. Anyway, I had to get that on – I had to record that because so far I've only gone on this rant on Twitter where Michael Malice is defending the new thing, and that just cannot stand.
Is he doing it just to argue with you, or does he actually
– I think he actually believes it, and it's shocking that he started citing the mainstream media and how they use it. And I said, yeah, this would be the first time ever the mainstream media was promoting degeneracy, right? So that was my way of hitting back.
I know the people at this point are like, are you guys going to come back to
economics? Are we still recording?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Did you know that I don't like the way you say coupon? Were you talking to me or are you talking to your audience when you said
no,
that?
I'm talking to you. The audience knows the correct pronunciation is coupon. I'm talking to you.
Okay. Well, it's not, but fair enough. Okay.
Anyway,
maybe last thing, should we bring up that what are the objections? Because Austrian libertarians, they don't like anybody else. And so what could anybody say about public choice?
Okay, so we actually have something negative to say about public choice. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm game for that. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, so it could be real fast, but it's.
And by the way, we say about the public choice. Oh, never mind. No, we don't. That's all right. That's all right. All right, go ahead.
We're going to dance around the issues here. Yes, the. So, like as I say, the standard stuff, and it's certainly well worth looking at the models. And as I say, there are a lot of things that make sense when you do read the public choice approach to things. Certain results pop out, and yeah, makes sense. But as Tom's already brought up, that there are revolutionary movements and things. The why would people suddenly rise up against a dictator? That the normal public choice framework could explain the initial equilibrium where you could have perverse results where. Most people in the society wish the dictator were dead, and yet nobody rises up against him because everybody else would shoot such a person. And why would those people shoot such a person? Because they know if they don't, then somebody else will shoot them. You know, you can build up these cute little game theoretic equilibria, and yet for some reason, if the oppression becomes too bad, the public does rise up and overthrow the dictator, even though some of them get killed in the process, and that's, quote, irrational. So, yes, the public choice school, there are those types of limitations, but then also... people who are Austrians and libertarians might object, especially in the Rothbardian tradition. For example, some of the big guns in this tradition, guys like Buchanan and Tulloch, and they focus a lot on constitutionalism, right? Like, so they'll say, because the public can be so irrational and because the incentives are perverse when it comes to public choice, we want to constrain the types of things that the government can do. And so that's why we need to adopt a constitution to take certain things off the table. We wouldn't trust it to democratic elections with so-called representatives because we know how screwed up that can get. And so you don't want the government forcing you to marry somebody. Let's just take that off the table. You know, you don't want the government forcing you to buy certain types of milk. Leave that up to the private sector. So they can do that, but I think there's a problem when they try to come up and then justify constitutional political arrangements. They sort of just push the question back one step and say, oh, okay, well, what reason do we have to believe that the process by which people are going to draft a constitution is going to be legitimate or, you know, is going to promote the public welfare? Why wouldn't we expect these same problems to creep in on that element? So again, somebody who is a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist, if you read the public choice material, you're probably going to be high-fiving them when they critique specific absurdities of the political system in action. But then when a lot of the big guns in this tradition try to justify the proper form of government, there's going to be a lot of gaping holes there.
All right. And you know where there won't be a gaping hole? The cruise ship that we're going to be traveling on for the
Absolutely
Contra
not.
Cruise. Okay. So ContraCruise.com, check that out. LibertyClassroom.com is where you can learn economics from people, you know, with PhDs who have been on this show and therefore are trustworthy. Bob's one of
the economics they kept from you.
That's right. And certainly given the fate of history of economic thought courses in economics departments,
yeah,
these are courses they kept from you.
I'm quite certain that my eighth grade history teacher knew all about Arrow's theorem and was like, no, I'm not telling you guys this.
But I mean, even in college departments, the history of economic thought has really fallen out of favor as a course to teach to undergraduates. So you're going to – but you need to know it. It's, and you're going to learn a lot of economics while you learn it. So that's Bob's most recent addition to our Liberty Classroom family, which is History of Economic Thought. So check that out over at libertyclassroom.com. Bob, thanks for chatting with me. I guess I'll be talking to you pretty soon for this week's episode of Contra Krugman.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Always a pleasure.
All right. That's it for my discussion with Bob Murphy. But I've got a site for you created by a listener of this show, and it's called 3dprintingrealms.com. Uses the number 3, 3dprintingrealms.com. And it's for people who are curious about this whole 3D printing phenomenon, which is indeed quite interesting that you could print out a gun or print out an object like this. What the heck is this all about? So you can find out all about it. Even if you're already interested in it, you'll still find something of value. That is to say, if you're already involved in it, you'll still find something of value at 3dprintingrealms.com. It explains it, and it shows you some of the best 3D printers and pens on the market, how they work and all that stuff. Great, great, very interesting. 3dprintingrealms.com. I highly recommend checking that out. And, of course, get a nice shout-out for your website if you get your hosting through my link. Plus, you get other really, really helpful bonuses that will keep you from pulling your hair out as you're starting a new website. Get those bonuses. Check them out at tomwoods.com/publicity. Tomorrow, the subject turns to Eastern Europe and what the heck is going on over there in the decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, hope to see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
So let's just think of one final point we can make that can also have a cheesy segue. That's the requirement.
I have another good example of how public choice is like makes sense of the world and is an improvement upon older versions of cynicism.
All right, give me a one-sentence thing of it so I can prompt you for it.
So a lot of times anti-government people say stuff like, oh, the government's so stupid, they're subsidizing tobacco farmers at the same time they're funding anti-smoking ads. What a bunch of idiots. No, they're not stupid. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, but on the other hand, wouldn't that in traditional terms make perfect, because doesn't subsidizing tobacco make it more expensive? So that is compatible with anti-smoking?
No.
No? Anti-smoking, if cigarettes become more expensive, I'm less likely to do it.
Subsidize something. If you're paying farmers to grow tobacco, then they're willing to grow it to sell it for less. It's not the government's buying the tobacco and holding it off the market. They're paying farmers saying, if you plant tobacco, we'll send you some money. So they're more likely to grow tobacco and then sell it for less than they otherwise would have.
Huh. Okay.
In other words, they're not sending people money to go buy cigarettes with, and that pushes up the market price of cigarettes.
Yeah, I guess it was that I was thinking of. Okay, I don't know why I was conceiving it that way.
Do you need to take the Liberty Classroom course?
I think. Yeah, I know. I know it exactly. All right. Well, good thing Chris would never allow this snippet to be aired. All right. You ready? We'll go back in. Okay.